Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Incumbent Congressman Peter Welch was first elected to the U.S. House in 2006. He's now served six terms and is seeking another term in November. All this month on Vermont Public Radio, we're interviewing the candidates for statewide office. And today our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Representative Welch is a member of the House Energy and Commerce Committee and also the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Representative Welch, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Representative Welch, let's start off with the news that we just heard from Washington, the vote on Brett Kavanaugh. It's a procedural vote, 51 to 49. We're going to learn more this afternoon when Maine Senator Susan Collins announces how she's going to vote. It is possible that she is going to vote no. What do you make of this whole situation?
Well, it's a terrible situation for America and for the institution of the United States Supreme Court. First of all, the notion that we would be having a candidate who could only get 51 votes, let's say it comes out to that, to serve on the court is an indication of how divided we are. You know, Justice John Paul Stevens, I heard him on the radio the other day, and he was somebody who started out saying he was supportive of Kavanaugh, but after he testified and saw the lack of judicial demeanor, does not support him. And I want to step back for a minute because I think what has happened here is that President Trump and Mitch McConnell have forgotten what is the fundamental role of the United States Supreme Court. It's not to be an advocate for the policy of a particular party or a particular president. It's to maintain the importance of that institution to be one of the checks and balances, a check and balance on the legislature if it crosses a line, but a check and balance on the president if it draws a line. And what we saw with President Trump is that he was unwilling to have a wide open candidate pool and delegated the vetting of who would be considered for the Supreme Court to an extreme right-wing group, the Federalist Society. That's number one. And number two, you saw Mitch McConnell say that when President Obama had a 1 year left on his term and made an appointment of Merrick Garland, Senate Majority Leader McConnell said, we are not even going to have a hearing on that. So it has created a politicization of the court that ideally under our system of checks and balances we wouldn't have. We'd respect the role of the independence of the judiciary, not to be a servant of a particular party or a president.
Now, the Republicans would say that the Democrats made a big mistake by making the Professor Ford's allegations public. And they said that it all should have been done in secret. Do they have a point?
I don't agree with that. You know, that decision about coming forward was essentially made, as I understand it, by Dr. Ford. And this is the challenge that victims of any kind of sexual assault have to face, because if they stay silent, they have to live with it themselves. If they step forward, as we saw with what happened to Dr. Ford, they become subject to attack. And in the case of Dr. Ford, President Trump actually mocked her. I mean, that is just outrageous and totally out of bounds. I think that is not a valid criticism.
You know, a lot of folks look at what was happening in Washington and what is happening in Washington, and they're coming to the conclusion that Congress seems to be a totally dysfunctional institution. Do you agree with that? And what, if anything, can be done to change this?
I do. It is dysfunctional. And in what has happened during the course of my time in Congress is I've seen it become more and more partisan. And the things that we need to do, whoever wins this election, this is going to be an opportunity for the American people to send a message that they want a mid-course correction from the Trump policies. But if Democrats are in the majority, and I think they will be, it won't be because people are buying what we're selling. It will be because people want us to stand up to the president's policies and reverse them. And it will give us an opportunity to earn the trust of the American people. And the most important thing for us to do in the House to make it more effective is to empower the committees and to take the centralization of power that's in the Speaker's office right now and distribute it to the committees. That's one. Number two, I'm working with a number of Republicans who share my concern about the dysfunction of Congress, where everything is decided in the Speaker's office. We want to have new rules which would say if there's a bipartisan bill, that's going to get a hearing. We want to have new rules where the minority, it's been the Democrats these past several years, always will have a right to propose an amendment to a piece of legislation. The bottom line is the way we operate in Vermont, contentious as sometimes our politics are, in Montpelier, there's give and take between both parties, and the minority is given the opportunity to have a voice. That doesn't exist in Washington. It will be much better for the political process if we restore it.
Congressman Welch, we got this email from Dave who wants to know if you think the Kavanaugh situation will help or hurt Democratic chances in November. Hasn't it shown us, says Dave, what's ahead if Democrats take control? If Democrats take back control of the House in November, the atmosphere, Dave thinks, will go from bad to worse because the Democrats will waste little time impeaching the president. I mean, we already hear this talk from some Democrats that if the Democrats take control of the U.S. House, impeachment of the president is priority number one come January. So how does that help the situation?
Well, that would hurt it. I mean, and that's not my view. I think Democrats, if we do win, we have to be humble about this. As I said, it's not that people are voting for us. They're sending a message that they don't like. This election is about President Trump. And people are going to weigh in with a yes or no, and they like what the president is doing. So if we, the Democrats, take the majority, then it gives us the opportunity to earn people's trust. And we will not earn their trust if what our agenda is about is retaliation. That'll get us absolutely nowhere. My view, our committees have to come up with concrete legislation that addresses some of the economic concerns of the American people. Like, for instance, a prescription drug price negotiation, bring down the cost of prescription drugs. Like an infrastructure bill that's going to get broadband built out into all of rural America. We do things like that that are concrete and practical and reach out to Republicans and invite them to be part of it when they're not under the heel of Paul Ryan, prohibiting them from acting independently. Then I think we may, A, make progress, and B, earn the trust of the American voter. So we've got to be about doing a job that makes a difference for the American people, not about getting vengeance because we've been in the minority.
So does that mean at this point you don't think the president is guilty of any impeachable offenses?
Well, my position on impeachment is that we've got to stand behind the independence of the Mueller investigation. Ultimately, Mueller has been doing a very aggressive, very thorough, and very professional job. And in fact, it's resulted in convictions of President Trump's campaign manager. It's resulted in convictions of his national security advisor and several campaign aides, and the indictment of many Russians who interfered in our election. And if there's going to be anything that comes out of this, including impeachment, it's got to be based on the thorough investigation by an independent Mueller investigation. So when that's done, all of us will have access to more information and be able to make a determination about what makes sense. But our focus should be on healing the country and restoring economic opportunity for the middle class in rural America.
Let's talk to Eileen, who's calling from St. Albans. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you.
What's on
Hello,
your mind
can you
today?
Hear me?
Yes, we sure can.
Okay, great. I am calling because, as I understand it, a job of elected official in Washington is to protect the lives and safety of Vermonters. And if Representative Welch agrees with that, can he explain how he can support the F-35 basing in Burlington with the knowledge that it will bring environmental harm to over 6,500 Vermonters, especially in light of the crash last week in South Carolina, this immature warplane? And will he ask that this basing be delayed until this plane can establish a solid safety record in light of its potential harm for the people of Burlington and its surrounding communities?
Well, first of all, the Air Force needs planes, and the new plane for the Air Force is the F-35. It has had a lot of problems and cost overruns, which I've been very critical. But that's the new plane for the Air Force. Second, we have the Air Guard, and they were held in such high regard that after a review, not involving members of Congress, but independent Air Force analysis, they decided that a basing alternative was right here at our Air Guard in Burlington. So I've supported that. And what I've seen and urged our Air Guard to do is to work with folks in the neighborhood to try to address some of the noise issues and do everything that can possibly be done to mitigate the impact on the local community. I mean, this is a situation where we've got an Air Guard that we really respect and revere, where the Air Force has a mission that includes planes, where our folks were designated as the receiver of this by an independent agency. So I have been supportive of the decision that has been made.
Congressman, let's talk about Medicare for All and health care. You've been a supporter of a government-financed health care program that would provide coverage to all Americans, so-called Medicare for All. Last week on this program, your Republican opponent, Anya Tino, said she was strongly opposed to this approach, and here's what she said.
So we are essentially still paying for health care. We're just taking any choice out of it. We're taking any competitive market out of it. And the government cannot afford to pay for everybody's health care without recouping that money in some form, and that would be in form of taxes. So ultimately, I think it hurts the American citizen.
So, Congressman, how would you respond to her criticism that a lack of private competition in the health care market will hurt this country's health care system?
We don't have competition in the market right now. I mean, take a look at Celgene. The CEO of Celgene, you know, drug manufacturer, he made $100 million. And how did he make that? He made it by boosting the prices on people who needed critical life-extending, pain-relieving drugs. It's a completely broken market. And bottom line, the United States pays the most and gets the least. So there's got to be some acknowledgement that the system is not now working. Third, whether you pay by taxes or you pay by premiums that increasingly stretch beyond anybody's ability to pay, there's an immense amount of money that is going into the healthcare system, some from private pay, some from taxpayers. And Medicare, which is a system that really works well and is very popular for people 65 and older, has lower cost and is much more efficient. And my view is that that system ultimately is what we want to get to, where everybody is covered. Everybody has to help contribute to the cost of it, and everybody has to get the benefit of it. A step that we could take that I'm one of the lead sponsors of doing is to allow individuals and employers to buy into the Medicare system when they become 50 or older. So one way or the other, we're all going to pay for it. But we have a system now where private companies are basically able to do a stick-up against employers who are trying to provide health care to their workers and to taxpayers who are trying to provide access to health care for seniors and for low-income people through the Medicaid program. It's broken, and we've got to address that and deal with it.
Congressman, there's some people who feel that if we don't get health care costs under control, it really doesn't matter how you finance it. You could do it with private premiums. You could do it with federal taxes. Is there some truth in that statement?
And there's enormous truth to that statement. That is exactly the point. The market is broken. You know, and I'll go back to pharma because that's the highest, fastest rising area of cost in health care. Pharma's ripping people off. You know, they do some good things, a lot of good things, by coming up with life-extending and pain-relieving drugs. They claim they need these wicked high prices in order to pay for research. The reality is that most of that research is funded by taxpayers through the National Institute of Health. And in many cases, what's happened is that pharma takes advantage of the pain and suffering that people experience, and where any of us, if we have a family member who needs a medication, will mortgage the house to get it if that's the difference between them living and dying. And pharma's got to just get real and not paying these $100 million salaries to executives. So the cost is the issue. And unless the government is willing to stand up for the consumer, and that includes employers who are really – they really want to provide health care to their workers, we've got to step in there and not let people get ripped off.
Congressman, we got this email from Susan. Would you support term limits? That was number one. And number two, would you ever support tying the minimum wage directly to congressional salary increases? So let's start off with term limits.
I don't support term limits. You know, it's a two-year term for members of Congress. And every 2 years, people have an opportunity to say yes or no to any of us seeking reelection. The other thing that's so important about those two-year votes is that it is the one office under the Constitution where if people don't like what's going on with the president, people across the country have an opportunity to say, hey, we want a mid-course correction. As far as tying the minimum wage to congressional increases, I would support having the minimum wage increased by inflation. In fact, we have that here in Vermont, and it's something that the Democratic legislature that I was part of, along with Governor Douglas, a Republican, put into the minimum wage increase that we had when I was last in the Senate. It would increase by inflation. So now we have $10.78 here an hour. I hope we can get to $15, but the national minimum wage is $7.50. As far as Congress pay raises, we haven't had a pay raise in 8 or 9 years. So I'm hopeful. I don't want minimum wage workers to be stuck with no raise.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Let's turn to Peter, who is calling from Shelburne. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thanks for taking my call. I have sort of a general question for the congressman. I definitely feel that you're doing a great job in Washington. My comment is, though, that I never really hear your views in public. I'd love to hear you on Fox News. I'd like to hear you on the PBS NewsHour. I'd like to know that, you know, our views here in Vermont are getting out to the rest of the world. But working behind the scenes is great, but, you know, we live in a world of public relations, and, you know, I hear Chuck Schumer, I hear Bernie Sanders. I don't hear from you.
Well, you're going to have to call those studios. I'd be glad to go on. I'm not sure Fox News wants me all that much, but I'd be glad to do it. But that's not a decision that I'm able to make. But anytime I have an opportunity to speak out in public, I do. And I appreciate your point about wanting to have Vermonters' point of view broadly and widely disseminated. So thank you.
Let's talk to Jacob, calling from Mount Holly. Hey, Jacob, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So, what my real question was is, he was saying at the beginning, if the Democrats take back over in this upcoming election, that it would be the voice of the people. I'm wondering if the Democrats don't take back over, what would he say with the people then speaking, and which direction would he go if that's the case?
Well, if we don't, I think that would be an indication of support for President Trump, and I would be disappointed. I really would be. I think that the guardrails of democracy are threatened. I think I've been astonished that we have a president who attacks people on the basis of their religion, who mocks a woman who talked about a sexual assault, who's attacked the rule of law, who has attacked independent journalism as fake news. This is not good for a country where we're very diverse, we have many compelling challenges, and where we need a political system that's based on checks and balances and mutual respect and cooperation. But if the voters ratified the direction the president is going, I'd put my head down and I would do every single thing I could to pass concrete legislation that allowed us to make progress and move ahead and bring people together. It would be very difficult to do that if we had a ratification of what's been happening in the House of Representatives these past 2 years, but I would do my level best to continue that effort.
Jacob, thanks for your phone call. Let's turn to Richard, who's calling from Montpelier. Hi, Richard. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for taking my call. Representative Welch, you've sat through thousands of hearings. Could you discuss with the listeners perjury and how often you've seen people charged with lying to the House, and what happens when they are charged with lying to the House? I'll take my call off the air. Thank you.
Well, I can't think of an instance where perjury has been charged. And number one, that's a prosecutorial decision. So it's not like – that's number one. Number two, perjury itself is a crime, and proving it, as I was mentioning, is very, very difficult. What you deal with an awful lot in testimony is people exaggerating things, fibbing things, having convenient lapses of memory. So the capacity of us to follow through on perjury, we're not a prosecutorial office. We're a legislative body. So it is pretty difficult to do.
Today on the program, our guest, Congressman Peter Welch. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, as I mentioned, your Republican opponent is Anya Tino. She said on this program last week that the two worst votes that you made in the last session are your votes against the tax bill and your opposition to the House Farm Bill. And here's what she said.
We have workers in many companies that have received benefits from the Tax and Jobs Act because it was passed without his vote. And we needed the Farm Bill to pass immediately to help the farmers be protected with the milk protection and all of that. So those two votes showed that he didn't understand the need of the people. He was voting party and not for the people.
So, Congressman, let's take these bills one at a time. Why did you vote against the tax bill?
Well, first of all, this had nothing to do with party. That tax bill is an abomination. I mean, this is a bill that is going to add $2.3 trillion to our deficit. The vast majority of the benefit, about 83% of the benefit, went to corporations in the wealthiest 1% in the country. The corporations supposedly were going to plow this money into productive activity and investment. They didn't do that. They have been on a record binge of buying back stock. All economists say that the least productive use of money for a corporation, investment-wise, is to repurchase stock as opposed to make investments in improving and increasing their business. So this is one of the first tax bills in history where the benefit has gone largely to people who don't need it, bypassed the middle class and lower income people, and where it was not put into productive use. And it's a tax bill where even if you got a modest benefit, our kids and our grandchildren are going to be the ones paying for it. And just as proof of this, a week after this tax bill was passed, and the question was to Senator McConnell, are you going to now proceed with an infrastructure bill? He said, well, we don't have the money to do that. And there's a direct link. Now, we've also been hearing a call for many on the Republican side who advocated for this bill that our budget is getting tight and we've got to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So this is a deficit exploding bill that wasn't put into like infrastructure or productive activity. And it's a debt that we've imposed on our children and our grandchildren.
Congressman, isn't it fair to say, though, that middle-income people who currently don't itemize on their tax returns will see a reduction in their tax burden?
It is fair. There was some benefit, some very, very modest benefit for some middle-income individuals, as you point out. About 13 cents on a dollar went to the vastly greater numbers of middle-income people than there are wealthy people. But that was not a price that's worth paying. I'd like to see us getting health care costs lower. I'd like to see us putting our money into infrastructure, and I'd be willing to even borrow money to do that because generations of Americans would benefit by a stronger, better infrastructure. But this was really a giveaway, and I think it was a very bad bill, and we're going to be paying for this for a long time.
Let's turn to the House Farm Bill. Why did you vote against that legislation?
It's because it was an attack on the nutrition program. Paul Ryan has had a goal, which he's been very explicit about. He wants to radically reduce nutrition programs in the Farm Bill. And there's two components to the Farm Bill, the nutrition programs, and in his proposal, $23 billion was going to be cut. That means our kids, veterans, seniors, disabled people, we're not going to have continued access to the nutrition program. The other parts of the bill, I'm supportive of. And in fact, I'm hopeful that eventually we're going to get a bill because the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, are much closer to where I am. And if we had an opportunity to vote on the Senate bill, I would support it because it doesn't have those nutrition cuts. And I want to say why that's important. Our economy right now, stock market has never been higher, and unemployment is very low. But what's also happening, childhood poverty is increasing. It's increasing, and it's because the policies you have with how the tax cut is skewed towards the very high end, how jobs and benefits are skewed towards the higher end. It's really resulting in this inequality, and a lot of people are falling behind, including kids. So why would we, at a time when childhood poverty is increasing, reduce nutrition in meals for kids who need to get a fair start in life?
Did that House Farm Bill also include a provision of having a 20-hour work requirement for someone who's qualifying for the nutritional programs?
Yeah, it did. And that was basically a way of trying to make it impossible for people to get benefits. Most of the people, the vast majority of people, first of all, they're either children or they're disabled adults or they're disabled veterans. And the other cynical part of the bill on the so-called work requirement was that the states were going to be given money supposedly or they were going to be given the burden of setting up these worker programs when there was no ability of the states even to do it. So that was an effort, I think, to under the guise of so-called work programs to basically cut benefits. And that's the real dispute. And the House Republicans with Paul Ryan want to cut nutrition radically right after they pass that tax cut. The Senate Republicans, by and large, and Senate Democrats and House Democrats want to maintain the nutrition program and move the Farm Bill forward. And I think we'll get there.
Also, Congressman, I wanted to talk to you about Russia's involvement in the 2016 election. It seems like several of this country's intelligence agencies have concluded that Russia did try to take steps to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. Are you concerned that the same thing might happen this year?
Yes. I mean, Russia will do it again if they can get away with it. And what's really quite astonishing is how all our intelligence agencies have concluded definitively that there was Russian interference in our election. The question for the Mueller team is whether there was any prior knowledge or collusion by President Trump or the Trump campaign. But I do share – I do continue to have that concern, and that's why I do believe we have to be fully cooperative to do everything we can to maintain election security.
Let's talk to Sister Lorian in Berlin. Hi, Sister. Welcome to the program.
Sister, welcome to the program.
Hello. So my question is, how can the House protect the environment – given that there are climate change deniers in the White House?
Well, I really appreciate that question. It's pretty bizarre to me that the president is denying the existence of climate change. And it's appalling to me what happened with Scott Pruitt, who instead of doing his job to try to protect the health and safety, the drinking water, the air we breathe, basically abused the EPA for his own personal gain. It's appalling to me that the United States, instead of leading, exited the Paris Climate Accords. So this is, I think, a major issue that we're going to have an opportunity to begin addressing if there's a Democratic Congress, quite frankly. And by the way, I'm part of a bipartisan climate change caucus. Many of my Republican colleagues get it. They know what a threat climate change is to our planet and to our health and safety. The other question for me, and this is really the mystery of why President Trump has his attitude as he does. A confident country doesn't deny a problem. It faces a problem. If we address climate change, doing the steps we need on energy efficiency, trying to do the best we can to be first in electric cars, doing what we can to get to green energy renewable sources, there's enormous economic benefit that can come from taking that challenge on, where we're going to have better jobs, more jobs, better salaries, and a cleaner environment. So we've got to focus on that. And I'm inspired by young people who know that, and in their personal conduct, they're not using plastic bags, they're using reusable water bottles, they're doing everything they can individually. But we also politically have to take the steps that if we take them, it's going to make us economically stronger and environmentally healthier.
Congressman, is one of those steps the imposition of a federal carbon tax?
Well, I'd favor that, because the carbon tax basically says that the external costs that are not reflected in the price of carbon are socialized. The private the profit is privatized, but the enormous costs are socialized. And of course, some of those costs are the enormous increase in wildfires, natural disasters, weather events that are costing us $1 trillion. So ideally, if we had something that reflected the true cost of carbon, and it should be done at a national level, I think that would be an economic indicator and a tool that would help us get to a greener economy.
Well, how do you make sure with a carbon tax that you don't really hurt low and middle income people?
Well, that's essential to make sure that you don't, and you'd have to do significant rebates, and it would all come into the design. I mean, the bottom line here is you call it a carbon tax, but in fact, if you buy a gallon of gasoline, you pay at the pump for what that is. But you don't pay at the pump, but you pay elsewhere on what that gallon and every other gallon that we burn into the atmosphere does to our planet. And we have to pay for it with the disaster relief. We have to pay for it with the mitigation efforts we have to make as sea level is rising. There are costs that are spread out all around. And if we are honest about what those costs are and reflect that in a properly designed carbon tax, I think that can work. But it has to be designed in a way where we make certain that everyday people who are driving to and from work, and that's their only option, they don't get hit on that.
Do you think such a system could be designed? I mean, are you asking people to pay up front and then get a rebate later?
Well, that'd be one way to do it. And you'd have to be very careful about that, because you don't want this to be essentially everyday people bearing the cost of what the oil industry has produced with pollution.
Congressman Peter Welch is seeking a seventh term in the U.S. House in the November election. Congressman, many thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you very much.
And I want to mention that coming up on Wednesday, October 17th, on Vermont Edition at noon, Vermont Public Radio and Vermont PBS will join together to sponsor a U.S. House debate with Congressman Peter Welch and his Republican challenger, Anya Tino.